Guide to Art, Activism, and Culture. I'm your host, Zoe Elena. This podcast is brought to you by the Aerogram Center for Arts and Culture, bringing the voices of today's creativity to you. Before we begin, please consider donating by going to our website at www.aerogram.org/support. Your contributions are why our events and programs like these are possible with no paywall so that everyone can participate for free worldwide. Thank you. Today's topic, investing in what change looks like. Joining me is cultural consultant and educator Larbeth Lima. With over 12 years of experience, Lima has worked with the Wellcome Trust, Art 21, Visual Aids, MoMA PS1, with a focus on intergenerational engagement, LGBTQ2SIA+ gender representation, youth engagement, and health equity, and is a founding member of the Love Yourself Project in New York City, and a member of the Committee to Empower Voices for Healing and Equity. Lima is currently a faculty member at New York University's Museum Studies Program and at Bard Prison Initiative.
Thank you, Larbeth, for joining me. I'm really excited to be featuring you on the Aerogram Center's podcast. You're a very special guest for me because you are also my professor.
Thank you for having me.
Can you introduce yourself?
Yes, of course. My name is Larbeth Silva Lima. My friends and family just call me Laura, like turn the music Laura. I identify as a queer, non-binary femme. I accept they and she pronouns. A visual description for anyone who might need it. I'm a person who has brown skin, locked hair to about my collarbone, and I wear glasses. I also am a professor of museum studies at NYU full-time and an adjunct professor at Bard Prison Initiative. I also, on the side, am a cultural consultant, and I work with various museums and cultural institutions on program development, supporting curatorial projects, as well as leading inclusive training and professional developments.
Yes, and I have invited you because I've been taking, for the past 4 months, your class on museum ethics. And I think that this is a really important time in museums who are now having to address their colonial frameworks and practices. But I think because ethics is such a broad term, I was hoping to invite somebody to be able to kind of distill what that means and what that looks like. In your opinion, what are the main ethical issues in museums today?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I agree with you. It's one of the leading conversations that we're having in the field at this moment. Ethics loosely refer to a branch of knowledge to deal with morals, right? To deal with principles. And that reflects how we govern ourselves in institutions. That can also extend to a person's behavior and just in general, any activity that's happening in a space. As you mentioned, cultural institutions and museums developed alongside colonialism, really harmful foundations. Also, they developed alongside, you know, the boom of industrialization, as well as medicine and science, which led to the roots of museums, as far as we know in a Western sense, or the sense that we're referring to in the 19th and 20th century, really classifying humans, human bodies, human remains, human experience in general. And this kind of foundation led to the perpetuation of false facts of science, which also include racism, eugenics, et cetera. Museums also developed alongside heteronormativity and really participating in what it means to have a family structure or to, you know, express oneself's identity, or also the ways in which, as communities, we're allowed to represent ourselves in these spaces. Museums also developed alongside the idea of class and gatekeeping and barriers. And most importantly, knowledge production and material culture, which all of was looted. You know, museums were founded through the stealing of objects and subsequently stealing culture. And so when you have that foundation, right, it calls into question, who are these spaces for, right? If we're founded on all of these kind of racist, homophobic, classist principles, who are these spaces for? And we know that it is typically upper class, white, elite, right? And these issues persist today. We continue to see colonialism and white supremacy play out in museum spaces. And unfortunately, this is directly linked to power power for a certain group of people and lack of agency for another group of people. So the response from the field right now is that museums and cultural institutions are attempting to correct these past wrongs that are well documented, that we know happened, that we know traces continue to be part of the field and the practice today. Some of these responses are calls for accountability. Some of them are open letters from community members or activist organizations. And several institutions are doing a great job of really listening, but some responses fall short and are performative. Some institutions don't really know where to begin, while others are sort of in their research phase of trying to develop actionable plans. But right now we're in a unique moment of seeing a variety of responses to these ethical issues, and really wanting to move forward as a field and say, we've been operating through governance that's really harmful for a very long time. And if we say we want to reach communities, we need to kind of rethink how we're, you know, modeling that behavior from within, right? It's not enough to be performative. What does that actually look like in the museum?
Yeah, that's incredibly poignant. Is what does it look like to share power, especially around knowledge?
Yeah, absolutely. We see a lot of examples that are kind of popping up at this time. In class, I've referenced MoMA PS1 in Queens, that they've done a lot of great projects recently. More notably, the exhibition Art in the Age of Mass Incarceration that was curated by Dr. Nicole Fleetwood. And we saw that that exhibition extended who gets to display their work in a museum. And so that work celebrated the artworks of artists who both have been incarcerated and some who have not, but perhaps had family or have family who are in contact with members who have been incarcerated or in communities that are affected. And thinking about, you know, the foundation of museums, classifying, looting, demanding what culture should be. And now we have major shifts where people who are deemed sort of the underdogs or the people who are powerless in these spaces or who are not represented actually being celebrated and given a perspective. And so that's a really good example of sharing that power and sharing that agency by, I don't want to say allowing, because that still implies that the museum has the power, but sharing that space, right? And it was not just the exhibition, it's also the programming around it, working with different organizations that work with incarcerated or previously incarcerated people to support them in getting back on their feet, right? And having them come to the museum and perform and share their work. That's beyond a one-off program, right? That's continued community. So it doesn't look like just doing the one exhibition, right? Or the one program. It looks like building relationships that continue to grow and evolve. And again, that's just one example. But to your point, we're not sure what that will look like for these institutions. We have to watch, right? Because it's not enough to do a couple exhibitions or programs. It's about that institutional change, because we know it's really at the root a governance issue. And so we have to see if this change is long-term or sort of performative responses to calls from the public. We'll see.
At this moment, since the pandemic from 2020 now into 2022, that there has been a massive social shift. And we are seeing museums at a crossroads on how to communicate with non-traditional museum goers because they don't see themselves represented. So how would you explain these issues for the general public to understand in a way that engages them?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So what I'm hearing is how to communicate with the public, but also engage them to be, you know, in community with us in these spaces. So much of my work and my museum career has really been around community engagement. So whether it's a Brooklyn Museum or the Museum of the City of New York, or even a small stint that I had at the Whitney Museum, my work has been engaging family audiences. And so, you know, that's a really intergenerational space, right? Of thinking about the needs of different demographics, age levels and backgrounds and cultures. So I've thought about this a lot. How do we welcome audiences in museums and talk to them about these topics in a way that feels authentic and that they really want to engage with us? You know, what we really need to do is break down those barriers, right? Because there's an extreme barrier between the public that wouldn't be a typical museum goer and the museum. They don't see the museum as a space for them. There's a lot of barriers around price points to even engage the space. They're not necessarily enough programs that might be relevant or familiar to them. When I think about engaging them, I honestly start with the museum, right? I start with the museum because what we have is a museum problem. And unfortunately, we're at a point in culture where if there's an issue, it tends to be the blame on sort of the victim, right? Like if that person didn't wear this, that wouldn't happen to them. Or if this person didn't do this, if they were just respectable, the cops wouldn't have engaged them, right? I think about that framework with museums. People often blame the public for not going, but I start with the museum, right? So how do we make that building and that space accessible, that huge, scary space that people don't want to go to? How do we find key staff that are working in the spaces that reflect the communities we aim to engage, right? And this is not about like tokenizing staff and being like, hey, like you're this culture, can you help me engage this culture, right? It's more about seeing like what staff reflect those values, because not everyone in the museum is there, right? So you have to find your people. Who wants to do this work with you? Who are your comrades in the museum that want to make that shift? And then do that internal work to make a program safe. When I was working at the Museum of the City of New York, we had the exhibition Gay Gotham. One of my colleagues, Stephen Veter, and I were really pushing for all gender bathrooms. Like we knew that we were gonna be welcoming audiences that typically hadn't come to the museum for this particular type of exhibition. So we needed to think about what does it look like for them to be safe and not policed in the space. Right. So I start always with what is the museum? What does the museum have going on? If I want to engage certain communities, what needs do they have? And how does that need to be addressed within the space? So that's one. Two, then I would engage the public. And whatever engagement I'm offering, whether it's a conversation or coming to a program, it needs to be based on mutual exchange. Right. A lot of times museums just start this work and then they think, oh, well, I'm going to welcome people and I'm doing them a favor because they're coming to the museum. Or maybe I have some refreshments and they're going to come. And they might find they're disappointed if people don't come. So what does that mutual exchange really look like, right? What's valuable to that community? What would make it reasonable for them to want to come to the museum space? So it has to be culturally relevant. And again, those barriers I talked about can't be up. They need to be broken down and very clearly communicated in whatever marketing is happening. And then the biggest thing that I talk about with this engagement is familiarity, right? That reason to be there. Who's that point person, right? Are you having a special speaker or event or a cultural program? Is there a stakeholder from the community who they trust that's going to be the bridge? It might take that extra level of work to, you know, find a stakeholder who will be a bridge. A good example that I have of this is the organization called Cool Culture. And what Cool Culture does is they work with different communities, oftentimes non-native English speaking communities, sometimes immigrant communities, to have a point person to bring an entire group to the museum. So they're not traveling alone. And so it doesn't feel like a scary new experience because they have someone who's kind of like guiding them through the process. And then what we find is that through having someone guide them to the space, then they're not so scared of it anymore, right? Then this like big, scary space isn't something that they don't understand. It's something they're familiar with and they're more likely to become repeat visitors. That's engaging the public. The third thing I would say is, as I mentioned before, go beyond the one-off program. It can't be that you're just inviting a group of people for a conversation to talk about restitution, right? It needs to be an investment in that community that is continuous, that creates a pathway that people want to come back, right? So that interaction has to be somewhat transformative and safe. And then you want to cultivate relationships with people, right? So those are my strategies. Start with the museum, engage the public truly where they're at with familiarity, and then go beyond the one-off program. And then once you've done those things, then you can start to have those real dialogues around these harder topics that you want their input in, but we're speaking different languages, right? So how do you create that common language? By building the relationship first.
How are those principles that you were talking about, because they can't sort of be one-to-one from events to exhibitions to museum employees, what sort of framework are you creating around ethics in that respect?
Yeah. So when I think about, you know, like your invitation here to think about how museums are really you know, top down, what does action really look like? You know, I think about how museums have long had this reputation or public perception of being the expert. Museums are often thought of as knowledge keepers, prestigious and elitist spaces. But the truth is that there are many forms of knowledge and many forms of ways of knowing. As we talk about often in my class, there are lots of different ways of cultural production and knowledge, right? And the root of this action that we want to achieve is in recognizing that museums have to find a way to value other modes of thinking, of archiving, and of sharing histories, right? Because what they're really trying to achieve is decolonizing the space, right? Equity in the space, abolition, right, of harmful practices in the space. And we're all trying to achieve that kind of inclusive utopian field. But in order to do that, we have to understand that we sometimes might get it wrong, that as cultural workers and museum workers, that we're not always right. In order to practice the values that museums would like to achieve, they have to be willing to accept that a shared agency is the only model around this, to try new ways of thinking and to share power. So in practice, what this could look like is expanding what curatorial work means. We know that curators have great power in taking care of the objects, selecting the objects, determining what an exhibition theme is going to be, what's in the exhibition, what group of people are represented. And that's power, right? Because you're sharing that currency of cultural capital and also financial capital. But that needs to be broken down, and that needs to be in concert with the communities you're engaging, right? It cannot continue to be that the curator is the expert. We know that curatorial practice is also linked often to higher education, having a master's or a PhD, experience in the field. These are extremely hard things to achieve, especially for working class people, especially for people at the margins, for BIPOC, queer folks, right? There are very low rates of people achieving the curatorial level. However, these museums are gatekeepers of knowledge. That structure needs to be rethought and reworked. It also looks like expanding what board structures look like. If you have people who are funding a space but don't necessarily understand the communities you're aiming to engage, that is a huge disconnect. And so we all know the age-old issue of having trustees that are problematic on your board, but wanting to kind of, you know, fawn and keep them because they keep the institution afloat, right? So if that needs to happen, what can an advisory board look like? What can another board look like? What are new creative structures that we can create that maybe one board is a funding board and one is actually driving the ethical vision of the institution, right? But those can't be the same because that's a direct conflict of interest that continues to plague our field. And then we have to be able to evaluate our own unethical histories. We talk about them regularly. BIPOC talk about this all the time. We talk about it in my classes. That this has to be a larger desire for every institution to really want to investigate what wrongs have happened in the past in order to develop an action plan to address the deep-rooted unethical governance of these institutions. We just saw that Harvard University had an evaluation to kind of develop an understanding of their roots and their responsibility in slavery, right? And through that report, they developed an action plan. Some of it was about reparations and money. Other practices were around the ways in which spaces and buildings would be used. Others were around values and behavior, right? So as museums, we should be doing the same thing. I'm not saying that the Harvard approach is perfect. There are definitely some critiques there, but we need to be able to look at our past wrongs and develop strong, concrete, actionable steps for how we move forward. It's not enough to just write a statement on the website. It's not enough to just do some PR move, right? Or just one exhibition. We need a 5-year, 10-year, 20-year plan, right? And then museums might become true sites of action, that communities can feel welcomed and, you know, they feel that accountability and that transparency that they want to engage with the space, right? So when I think about abolition and all the things that drive my practice, It looks like mutual aid. It looks like community. It looks like imagining safer futures. It looks like different people at the table. It looks like all of our voices matter. I would love to see more diverse voices and power at the table. And again, these actionable steps are possible, but it takes really rethinking the structures and the frameworks that we've been using for so long. As Dr. Portia Moore says, you know, burn down the ashes and rise from the ashes with new models.
Sort of a good transition. So when I talk to people not in the museum field, someone like my mom, their eyes glaze over because terminology like decolonizing equity or abolition is so ideologically weighted. So what do these terms actually mean and what are they doing as it relates to the museum?
It's interesting because we develop all these terms and they tend to become sort of buzzwords, right? What's interesting is they actually come from activists and organizers to begin with. And then the institutions start using them in a performative way to say that they are aligned with these values, to say that they are being accountable, but then we don't really see the true action. And so it's kind of this cycle of being called in, responding in a performative way, not really seeing any action, being called in again, responding in a performative way. And it just continues to change as the language continues to change. And I think language is such an important tool and vehicle we see throughout time is constantly shifting. But you're right. When I think about my mom, I was born in Cape Verde in West Africa. My mom, you know, worked as a housekeeper for most of her life. My dad worked in factories. They know I work in museums, but they have no idea what I'm talking about when I'm referring to these things because their focus is survival day to day, really just supporting their family, right? And then we have the privilege to work in these spaces, the privilege to try to move them forward and to make them more inclusive for people like our parents, for people like our families back home, wherever we're from. Unfortunately, we do have to engage and meet sort of, for lack of better terms, the masters where they're at, right? And we have to engage these super academic conversations because that is a tenet of white fragility. Right? White fragility is rooted in sort of like the factual, the academic, the scientific, the proof, the lawyer energy, right? And that is not to say that our communities aren't brilliant and capable of having these conversations, but our focus tends to be more on things that are related to like just family and safety and mutual aid and caring for one another, right? So when I think about terms like decolonizing, equity, abolition, all these things that, you know, cultural workers and organizers bring into the fold, they're coming from a space of healing. They're coming from a space of wanting to undo structures that have been intrinsically harmful to people of color, to BIPOC, to queer folks, et cetera. But the institutions take them and warp them into these kind of academic dialogues of needing to kind of like prove and be defensive. And that's troubling for me because at the root, we're talking about abolition. What we're saying is that we do not want to support structures that aim to suppress and oppress people. And we know that there's documented history of systemic issues around policing, around education, around housing equity, around social services, around healthcare that disenfranchise certain communities. And museums then become the structures of replicating these systemic issues, right? And so what we want is a space where museums don't need to be bogged down with academic language. We want them to be spaces that don't need to be exclusive and prestigious and that you need to be, you know, reaching a certain level of education to engage them. That's like the very goal, right? When we talk about museum engagement and community engagement, we're talking about meeting people where they're at, that it's a space for everyone. Right. And so when I think about what abolitionary work can look like in museums, it's those intergenerational programs. It's those programs that everyone's there, no matter what educational background or what fashion or how your behavior is being policed in the space. Right. It's about everyone being there, being seen, feeling safe. And I think that's what we need to work towards as a field.
And you recently collaborated on the Guadalupe Maravilla Tierra Blanca Joven exhibition at the Brooklyn Museum. Can you share more about that project and how you were approaching museum work and visitor experience?
Yeah, sure. So I am a cultural consultant for an organization called the Wellcome Trust, well spelled like W-E-L-L, well. And the Wellcome Trust is a charitable foundation that's focused on health research. They're based in London and they were established back in the 1930s and have their own problematic history that they've worked to address. And they do so by having these huge public art projects that are often global, one of which is called Mindscapes, which I'm a part of. And so I'm particularly consulting on Mindscapes, which is a sort of new international cultural program about mental health. And it aims, you know, to support major collaborations that are around the world, from like New York to Tokyo, with satellite partnerships in other locations. So Guadalupe Maravilla is the artist in residence for Mindscapes. So there are lots of different projects going on, but Guadalupe's work is one of the major focuses right now. And so the exhibition Tierra Blanca Joven, or Joven, sometimes my Portuguese comes out, it's pronounced Joven, which opened in April at the Brooklyn Museum. I worked with my colleagues, Rebecca Jacobs and Danielle, who is our sort of overseer supervisor at the Wellcome Trust. We sat in with the Brooklyn Museum on various meetings around curatorial development, program development, as well as not just the exhibition space, but also the healing room, which the teens at the Brooklyn Museum really developed and took the lead on. And they were guided by Lindsay Harris, who's interim director of education there. And so my role was really just stepping in on those meetings, supporting any way that I could, but also really helping to develop the programming. So we just had a program back in April and we're having another one in the summer. And, you know, the first one was extremely moving, thinking about how we reach undocumented communities and queer communities and healing work, which is a good point to share a little bit about Guadalupe. So Guadalupe, you know, identifies as a transdisciplinary artist who's from El Salvador. Guadalupe is currently in Brooklyn, has lived in Virginia, but is one of the first wave of young people to come from Central America in the 1980s who are undocumented. Through Guadalupe's work, you know, he's really trying to pay homage to his own migratory history and thinking about how historical and contemporary contexts of immigrant culture, notably belonging to Latinx communities, impacts his own work and his own healing. He's a person who had intestinal cancer and through his artwork was able to heal himself. And so his work is really expansive and immersive, incorporating choreographed rituals, handmade costumery, fusion of music, smells, theater, audience, ritual, shrine, ancestral medicine, and participation. And essentially, Guadalupe's work is art as healing. And that's where my particular research comes in around museum work, thinking about health, art, and activism in that intersection, which is one of the reasons I was asked to consult on this project. So if you go to the museum, you get to see it, you'll see that one of the drums or sort of gong structures and one of the pieces called Disease Thrower is in the exhibition. And what Guadalupe does is activate these gongs and create sound baths that are healing. He's done this in so many capacities, whether it be a church, whether it be in the gallery, whether it be at Socrates Sculpture Park, where he had a huge installation last year. And his work really aims to heal both himself and others. I'm also working on a project called Cloud Swing, which is designed by Isometric Studio. And so the Cloud Swing is an accessible swing that has spaces for people with both manual and powered wheelchairs to swing, as well as people with larger bodies to just think about body inclusivity. And so I'm helping to develop programming around accessibility, visibility, around radical joy and disability justice on that site. So Mindscapes has been a real pleasure to think through, you know, cultural work in the city. And again, the ways that we invite different types of audiences who aren't traditionally invited to a space to see themselves represented. That representation is so important. So having those programs with Guadalupe and being bold about talking about undocumented communities in the museum space, to me, is where museums should be heading.
I had recently interviewed Miguel Luciano, who was a former artist in resident at the Met. He explained an initiative that he started creating Element t-shirts and that would go towards a Latinx fund. And so I'm interested in how artists are pressuring the museum to make actionable change because they have that in. But you also have organizations like Decolonize's Place or Strike MoMA that have been challenging the frameworks of museums. And I'm seeing more pushback. How does one approach social justice and activism? What are those conversations like inside the museum?
Yeah, I think that's such an important question because we're at the point in history where being complicit is not really an option. As we've seen through the movement, museums are not neutral, right? Even if you're not saying something, that's choosing a side. So I think the first thing, if you're a person who's wanting to engage social justice and activism within the museum, if your museum isn't already doing it, and they should be, it's to understand your why. So first you need to consider your own positionality. What are points at which you're oppressed and points at which you have privilege, and understand the topics that you're trying to engage and understand your why. Why do you want to be engaged in social justice? Not to say like you shouldn't, but to understand your intentionality behind the decisions and your approach, right? Are you doing this for self-advocacy? Are you doing this for solidarity with another group? Or are you doing it for both? For example, as a Black person working in museums, I definitely am always advocating for Black Lives Matter to be a reality in institutions, but I also stand in solidarity with Asian lives. I also stand in solidarity with disabled lives. Etc. Right. And I also have intersectional identities where I advocate for Black and queer people as a queer person. Right. So you need to understand your why. Are you doing self-advocacy, solidarity work? And the reason you need to be able to parse the difference is because then you can consider your how. Right. Because if you're a person who's doing solidarity work, you might want to be strategic and not taking up too much space. Right. Whereas if you're doing self-advocacy work, you also need to navigate the reality of maintaining your position in the institution while also understanding your rights and advocating for those. So once you've understood your why, then you can consider your how. So you have to start where you're at, right? What is your institution landscape? What is safe and what is not safe in the space for you? What communities surround you? So who's already organizing in the museum? It's really helpful to know. And then not just within the museum, but within the local communities, right? Who's already organizing? Understand the work being done first, right? Because sometimes with organizing or new organizers, we're just so excited. We just want to jump in and do everything we can. But it's also important to kind of have regard for people who have been organizing around an issue for a long time and kind of feel out what has already been done. So you can find your place, because we always want to kind of work towards solidarity, right? Because we know that we're stronger in numbers. So understanding the kind of what's happening already around you, and then understanding your own self in terms of your skills. What do you want to contribute, right? Are you a person who's going to be giving to the movement in terms of, you know, creating posters? Are you a digital graphic designer and you're creating the social media production and marketing tools? Or are you really skilled at negotiation skills and you have that kind of lawyer energy? Are you going to be the person negotiating in the room or crafting a statement to the museum space? There's a lot of organizing that goes on within museums, oftentimes that is with the support of surrounding groups such as Decolonize This Place, right? And so it's really important to understand yourself, the field, what's happening around you, and then what you can best bring to the space, how you want to bring yourself in the best capacity to that work so that you're actually helping to push forward. And so it's a selfless thing. It's important to know how to not burn out. It's important to know how to take care of yourself. Take breaks when you need it so you can come back stronger. And then again, what issues you want to be mobilizing around, because we can't possibly do everything, right? So thinking about what issues are the most pressing for you at the moment. You can be in solidarity with everything, but when you're giving your work and your time, you often do want to focus on something so you can be of best use to support that issue. I encourage everyone to really look at what's already happening in their institution. and see what ways you can support that work.
I feel like that was the question that I've brought up in class discussions around burnout and the pressures of being a BIPOC employee or intern, and not just in the museum space, but in work environments where you feel that pressure to be representative of, like, let's say if you were Latinx, that you represent all of Latinx history and culture. And
yeah, I think it's important to not see yourself as a monolith, right? You don't represent everyone in your group, because there's so many nuances and so many intersecting identities and ways we're oppressed and have privileges in different ways. And so it's important to kind of bring different people into the fold, right? If you feel like you're the only person representing a group of people, it might be helpful to consider who else is in that museum space or surrounding community and invite people to join you. They might not know the work that's happening and they might want to participate, but it's about welcoming people and inviting them, understanding if they can't or they don't have the capacity, or if it's not safe for them, right? Not shaming people. If it's not safe for them, maybe they really need their job and they can't risk, you know, being fired, or maybe they haven't come out yet, right? And so maybe you can assume they're a queer person, but maybe they're not out and it's not safe for them to be yet, right? So respecting when people can't be in solidarity visibly, but also being brave enough to reach out and ask for that support, right? And to, again, just like really hone in on those who are already doing the work. But it's so important to share it, because the responsibility can't be on one person. And it is unfortunate that those who are in power in the institution, the decision-making power, the fiscal power, are often the ones who need the educating. And then those who are making less money, who tend to be the frontline workers, who tend to be forward-facing visitor service, education staff, et cetera, are often the people of color, right? And are often the ones who do the educating in the institutions without compensation, right? Because you're doing the work to advocate for yourself, for others like you, and for future museum professionals, and you're not being compensated for organizing, right? Organizing is a very selfless thing to do. So it's a balance of not wanting to speak for everybody that's like you, but also wanting to stand up for people who are like you, and also taking care of yourself, right? So you have to be really intentional, right? It's not just jumping in. It's not just going to marches. And, you know, it's not just writing a rash letter to the institution. It's really finding that solidarity and being strategic about your approach and taking care of yourself along the way.
Do you think that because people who are in positions of power have that academic knowledge, and so therefore they are in a position of power, where people who are kind of kept in lower positions, so like education department or more people of color, do you think that that's because sort of like a difference in culture and ways how people approach community?
Yeah, I think that people in power in museums, it's definitely linked to their education level. I think it's definitely linked to nepotism, right? People who like have, you know, a friend or a cousin that they're helping to get a job, or maybe even if it's not nepotism in a personal sense, but it's like maybe went to the same university, or you have a positive bias towards someone who's like you. That's typically how we've seen most fields work up until this point in history that we've been calling out, you know, racism, classism in most work fields, right? And so it tends to be that people of color are in the education positions or the visitor services positions that pay less and that have less power, not because they're not qualified, not because they might not even be educated, but because they're less likely to have that cultural capital of a network. It's very hard to get into a museum position, period, especially one such as curatorial or development or those higher paying positions, right? You have to have the experience and you have to have, in their terms, the pedigree. And how do you get access to that at this point in history? We know is linked to prestigious education, not just education. We know it's linked to certain social groups. We know it's linked to certain culture. And like you're mentioning, also behavior, right? This idea of like code switching, and the performance of whiteness, right? And how much proximity does a person have to whiteness in extremely white spaces, right? That's still playing out in these institutions. And so what we're starting to see is more people of color, more people with braids in their hair who look different, more trans bodies taking up positions of power. But again, they still continue to be at this point in history, the firsts, right? This museum hires their first Black woman director, or this museum hires their first trans this and that, or the Met hires their first Native American curator, right? We're still in the age of firsts. And that's very sad, right? And so we need to get to a place where we're valuing humans for all their rich identities and cultures and contributions that are not linked to power and prestigious education, but linked to the things that we say we value, right? And so that shift is starting to happen, but it's one that's happening slowly, unfortunately.
Just a lot of work ahead.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many times I've been a first. And like, it can be frustrating to be the only, you know, person of color in a room, right? And then there comes, you know, a trade-off with that, because there is a level of code switching, there is a level of compromising yourself to keep the position, and there is a level of having to pick and choose what you advocate for, because it can be really exhausting to constantly be the one advocating and teaching, right? So on top of the job you've been hired for, you're often teaching, or people expect extra labor of you because of your positionality, right? And so having a positionality that's unique in an institution is unfair. There should be more variety, and there should be more diversity at the table. So it's not all on that one person to do that work.
What I appreciated about your class is those conversations of advocating not just for yourself, but for your peers. What are your challenges of bringing ethics to life for your students?
I love teaching ethical frameworks for museum work in my museums and community class, because it's an opportunity to really support students as they're thinking about who they want to be in the field. You know, when I think about challenges around it, it's really around the weight and responsibility of being an educator. There's great power in becoming an educator and having that position and not wanting to abuse it, right? Not wanting to be sort of like a top-down type of educator, but wanting to be horizontal and understanding that we all learn from one another, right? I may have more experience in the field. I may have more experience with research, or I may have acquired more knowledge as a result of my age. But at the end of the day, we can all learn from one another. So I really think about the classroom as a space to help my students feel free. How can you be the most authentic you? So you'll want to share, so you'll want to engage and explore your ideas. How safe do you feel to make mistakes, right? To play with your thoughts and ideas and your development without feeling shame as you're learning. I think about preparing my students for not only the world, but their careers and also this particular field. So that means equipping students with the best tools to succeed in this field. And success for me is not about kind of meeting the needs of, you know, those old ethical frameworks we talked about, but actually how they feel safe to be in their skin, in their intersectional identities in the field, right? So tools for me look like, how do you advocate for yourself? How do you understand the history so you can understand where the field should be going in the future? How do you understand the landscape of activism that's happening in advocacy so you are empowered to know what you deserve and what your rights are? And how do I help you develop your confidence so that if a space is not for you, you have the confidence to say no, or you have the confidence to stand up for yourself, or you have the confidence to say, maybe something else, right? Maybe I'm going to try another job, right? And so this field has functioned so much off of, well, you don't get paid enough, but you should feel so lucky to work here. You should be so lucky to be around these objects and this history and this prestigious culture, and the trade-off is sort of clout, right? And what I say is that's not enough, right? Actually, the field is really lucky to have you, because we're at this critical crossroads of change, and the younger generations have invested in what change looks like. So you're actually all the next generation, you're the asset, because you're the ones who have the frameworks and the language and the energy to come in and kind of rework and reshape these structures. So for me, it's how do I support my students to see that, to see their brilliance, to see what they have to offer and to value themselves while also navigating, you know, being diplomatic and being true professionals and developing their skills and professionalism, right? Some things that I think about are bell hooks, who's given us so many amazing, you know, tools for how to teach through either teaching community or teaching to transgress. But one quote that I like is, you know, engaged pedagogy does not seek to simply empower students, right? Any classroom that employs a holistic model of learning will also be a place where teachers grow and are empowered by the process. So I see my classroom as the community, right? I see my classroom as the mutual aid where we're learning structures of sharing with each other, helping each other, and a space where you can be real. You can have bad days. You can be burnt out and communicate it. You don't have to perform a false toxic positivity. You can be who you are and show up, and that I will welcome that. Teaching is a very special gift and level of power that I take seriously. And ultimately, I want my students to feel free.
Do you have any final thoughts or announcements you would like to make?
The last thing that I'll say is that the field is changing. There's a lot of shifts happening, particularly around ethics. And I hope that folks who are in the field will be engaged around that and be part of the future. And rather than digging heels into the governance of the past, right? So I hope that we will move together towards safer futures where everyone can see themselves reflected and represented on the walls of museums, and where everyone can walk through the space without feeling policed, and where everyone can walk through the space and feel it's truly for them. And that's why we stay in this field, as problematic as it may be, because we believe in culture and we believe in preserving it and sharing it. And we believe in those safe futures for everyone in these spaces. And Zoe, I want to thank you for having me today and for this wonderful opportunity to be in dialogue with you and your generation, your class. You're also brilliant, and I can't wait to see what you will all do.
I have been your host, Zoe Elena. Join us on our next episode. And in the meantime, be sure to follow us on social media to learn about opportunities, events, and more.